Applying the latest information technology developments to the greater public good is never easy. In this Gov 2.0 plenary session, speakers talk about their experiences and insights as to why groups succeed and sometimes fail in their attempts to adopt the latest technologies. From IT Conversations. Hi, I'm Phil Wendley, the executive producer of IT Conversations. Today I'm excited to bring you another presentation from the Gov 2.0 conference.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's Gov 2.0.
So I'm Dan O'Neill from EveryBlock, and really happy to be here at Gov 2.0. This is definitely where we belong. We are one of the sponsors of the conference, and my mission is to talk to everybody in this room before Thursday. But I do have 5 minutes. Let's roll with some lightning there. So what I thought I would do is some case studies. EveryBlock has been at this for a while, for about 3 years now, and we have some things that we've learned. So I thought I'd share. So just briefly, EveryBlock is a website that pulls together local news and public information into one place. So you can put in your address, and you'll see things near you right down to the block level. We have lots of interesting stuff like property transfers, lots of information from people that we get directly in this room. So thanks. Thanks for that. And keep supplying that. So building permits, restaurant inspections, foreclosure, stuff like that. One thing that we have, building permits in Chicago. This is actually, I was going to start the case studies a little bit later. This is a good case study because the guy, when I first asked for this stuff, the one lesson we learned, go ahead and ask for it. Because they might give it to you. When I asked him for it, he said, no, we won't give you that. And then I asked a few dozen more times, and then finally they gave it to us. And then I realized the commissioner called me up, and he said he was going to give us the building permit data every month. And then five building inspectors got indicted a couple weeks later. So I thought it was sort of like some pre-PR that he was doing. So you never know. That's the lesson there. So let's move on with some more case studies. One of the things that you need to know about EveryBlock is that we started, our DNA is in ChicagoCrime.org. That was in May 2005, launched by Adrian Holovani and Wilson Miner, who I work with, and it turned into EveryBlock. Here's one thing that we learned. Politics can ruin information. I worked in January 2006 as a contractor for the city of Chicago, and we came up with a project called ChicagoWorksForYou.com. It was a great idea, had a lot of good stuff in it, and it got kiboshed. So that can happen. On the other hand, ambition can lead to information. One key performance indicator that I've seen of a municipality that has good things happening is a chief executive who wants to move up. We saw a couple of them. Quiet cities can innovate too. Anybody here from Charlotte, Mecklenburg County? Thank you. They had a data store made in 2002. Not an abs contest, just pure data. Great stuff. Data can get confusing. Los Angeles crime. Sometimes we can propagate mistakes that we see throughout the data. One thing that I really wanted to touch on is there's a lot of people in this room who EveryBlock and we wouldn't be here if it weren't for them. It's people who have been doing GIS and these kind of goofy applications that we see on the web all the time, like this from Dallas. It's just an FTP site. It's the city of Dallas. And they have this crazy crime data right there, and it has these really amazing details inside. You'd never know that by looking at the page. One thing that we always want to keep in mind at EveryBlock, there are human beings behind this data. Sometimes you can see it and it can look really dry, but you know, there's people, you know, police officers and criminals and people calling the police. There's actually real people behind it. I've heard a lot about apps contests. We think that app contests and showcases are great. We just launched the city of Portland, and it was because they had a civic apps contest. Maintenance can be really tough, and I would urge anybody who's considering an apps contest, the actual update of the data can be really tough to maintain, and it can lead to some real issues. One thing we've learned is goofy databases, not in the apps contest, the ones that have an actual budget behind it, the ones that actually, you know, that have human beings who are maintaining it, that works really good, right? They never seem to break, and they keep rolling. So stuff like the New York City building permit BIS system. One thing we're always interested in is incremental improvement. City of San Francisco and the police department, they deserve a lot of credit for going from kind of a goofy little map that we had a difficult time scraping and turning into and going into really well-formed XML. So what it comes down to is, with my remaining seconds, is so what, right? So what? We have all this data. Well, the thing that, we are interested in doing is making more connections among people, connecting and helping people make their block a better place. So I'd like to talk to all of you. Can we do that? Next couple of days. Thank you.
Chief Judge Robert M. Bell of the Maryland Court of Appeals, the state's highest court, has a quick response for when he hears himself or one of his colleagues referred to as a justice. He says, "There is no justice in Maryland." Quite a tongue-in-cheek response, huh? But it's also a little bit of a nod to the many people in Maryland who can't resolve their legal problems because they don't know what to ask the court for, and they can't pay somebody who does. Of the three government branches, the judicial system is probably the most opaque. The law is complex, the processes are mostly undocumented, and the system assumes that everyone has an attorney, which isn't true. Lawyers are guaranteed in only criminal cases. In civil cases, like protection orders, evictions, foreclosures, that they're not. Funding for legal aid, the lawyers who are provided for people who cannot pay, is decreasing, and even middle-class families are struggling to pay for legal services. So more people are representing themselves. I imagine, personally, that it feels a little like filling out your taxes, knowing that if you make a simple mistake, you're going to lose your home or your children, sort of a terrifying consequence. Courts know that a problem exists, so they're innovating. They're adopting creative solutions that require them to work with community partners and use technology. The most important tool that is used by courts are forms. Almost every other strategy relies on forms. The court form outlines what information you need to provide for a court so that they can make a decision in your case. But as you know, people still fill out forms wrong. As a solution, courts have found many mistakes can be prevented if people use online interactive interviews that generate the court forms for them. Many of these interviews are posted on LawHelp Interactive, a national system that is funded by the Legal Services Corporation, a federally funded entity. LawHelp Interactive pools resources so participants can benefit from each other's work and avoid duplicating infrastructure, which is a waste of resources. At the core of LawHelp Interactive is HotDocs server. It allows the interviews to be published online, and using these interviews, people can answer questions, generate documents, and can even reuse their answers on other forms if necessary. Interviews are created and posted by non-technical people. They use HotDocs Professional and A2J Author, a product of the Center for Access to Justice and Technology at the Kent Law School. A simple document can be put together and tested in a matter of hours. LawHelp Interactive started as a project of an Ohio legal aid program. In 2006, ProBonoNet was asked to be its steward due to our mission and history of working nationally with local partners to increase access to justice through technology, volunteerism, and collaboration. One of the courts involved is the New York City courts. In 2005, they realized 75% of people in the New York City Family Court and 90% of people in the New York City Housing Court appeared without a lawyer. So they created forms that people could print and fill in. This helped, but wasn't enough. When they were approached by a legal aid program about partnering to create online interviews, the court decided to give it a try. My colleague Claudia Johnson and I have had the privilege of working with them, helping them to share what they've learned in the interviews that they've created. They've replicated interviews that are used by other organizations around the country. Their first interviews were posted in 2007. Based on the results, they expanded the program statewide, and more interviews were posted in 2009. During that year, over 25,000 forms were filled out online, and in the first quarter of 2010, they filled out more than 12,000 documents. Feedback is outstanding. People are grateful the resources exist, and judges and court staff are thrilled because the forms are legible, and the cases move faster, and they don't have to explain procedure. But this is not just happening in New York. Nationally, court forms and legal documents are being simplified and automated. Many courts are taking the lead, but in places where the courts are reluctant, legal aid programs are going ahead on their own. I'm constantly amazed at the innovation in my community. Several states are moving beyond court forms. In Kentucky and Oklahoma, they're working with child support agencies. And in Maine, Pine Tree Legal Aid took and that they estimated food stamps and TANF benefits. Maryland is also building online interviews for Law Help Interactive. It's a small project. So while there still may not be justice in Maryland now, at least the courts are getting a little bit closer.
I'm Rita King. I'm the innovator in residence at IBM Analytics Virtual Center and a security futurist at the Aspen Institute. But I'm here today to talk about cities and networks of the future. I was going to give a presentation about what I learned in Greece this spring about the relationship between technology and democracy. While I was there, an alleged terrorist ring was busted a few blocks away from where I was staying, and that was before the riots began and the economy publicly collapsed. Greece is a monument to the timeless effort to augment and enhance reality, not unlike the Herculean effort that Gov 2.0 is now making to change with the changing times. But while I was working on my presentation, something even more cataclysmic occurred, the volcano with the unpronounceable name. I was in London when the eruption took place. Like thousands of other people, I became a volcano refugee when a massive cloud of ash suddenly illuminated what is usually hidden, worldwide economic and cultural interconnectedness. I ended up at the magnificent Guggenheim in Bilbao after a 35-hour ferry ride from the UK. And in Bilbao, a giant flowered dog made it immediately clear that unexpected creative magic can completely transform a city. The poet Wallace Stevens said, "The imagination can only conceive of the world for a moment, a particular time, place, and culture, and so must continuously revise its conception to align with a changing world. As worldviews come and go, each person is pulled between the influence the world has on imagination and the influence imagination has on the way we view the world, or in this case, how we view Detroit." The next slide is a small map of an area in Detroit. The blue rectangle represents a new type of community forming there. The community is an experiment in micro-ownership of shared assets. It's called Loveland. Each parcel in Loveland is a single square inch. So far, there are over 600 people in the network sharing the space, which expands daily. I'm an Inchvestor. My neighborhood, the Imagination Age, is shown in yellow. It's 1,000 square inches. The next slide is a detail of the Imagination Age neighborhood. It's a map. 1,000 inches are divided into 9 zones with shared space for cultural and economic development. This project is being documented by filmmaker Jesse Dillon. While Gov 2.0 is also struggling toward meaningful reconstruction, the connection between this project, the brainchild of artist and entrepreneur Jerry Paffendorf, and Gov 2.0 might not be immediately obvious. But in the 1930s, $7 billion was spent on WPA, the Works Progress Administration. Millions of people were hired to carry out public works projects. Nearly every community benefited. Muralists like Diego Rivera were commissioned to beautify buildings. 9-year-old Detroit girl Ricky Collins, who lives in the only house on her block that isn't abandoned, understands intuitively that she now has hundreds of neighbors from all over the world because of Loveland. But is Loveland real? These two houses in Detroit are part of the project. The house on the left will be the Imagination Station, dedicated to public art. The house on the right will be used for skills creation and digital literacy. The Imagination Station will be located to the left of the abandoned Michigan Central Station. Vision and effort will transform these structures. Our hope is that Detroit will become a city of the future once again. Once these buildings are renovated, the network can start to create what the network needs, starting with jobs. These facilities will benefit local people as well as those who live on the network globally. This entire process of reconstruction and transformation will be captured by a special solar-powered camera created to document processes in public spaces without access to electricity. The archives from this process will be curated partly in Jesse Dillon's Inch. In addition to being a filmmaker, he serves as the curator of mysteries of the Imagination Age. He's committed, like many others, to this process of creative reconstruction. In order to be powerful, the imagination must lead to the real, at which point the line between the two realms dissolves, just as the line between virtual and physical disappears when real-world benefit becomes apparent. Thank you so much for being here tonight. I'm happy for the chance to share this with you, and I hope that you will consider being a part of this effort to create a network and a city of the future. Thank you very much.
Hi there. I'm here because I wrote a 400-page book about the government as a digital media maker. It has 70 pages of footnotes, but fortunately, it can be compressed into a relatively simple thesis. There's an inherent conflict between regulation and content creation, and that government agencies have an inherent anxiety about digital files because they can reach unintended audiences and be used for unimagined purposes. I also give awards, but not the kind that anyone here wants to win. They're called the Foleys, after disgraced Congressman Mark Foley, the one who sent those text messages to underage pages. And each year I try to recognize the very worst in government media making, particularly if it can get really embarrassing on the internet. After all, things like access and transparency sound really great until someone's found the location nuclear materials, TSA manuals, or a lot of Social Security numbers, thanks to your government website. What can you do about this? Not much, but here are a few tips. Number one, don't promise what you can't deliver. This diplomat from the State Department promised to look into the detention of a Chinese blogger. It turned out to be a really sensitive matter, and the tweet was even deleted. Don't pander, especially to children. Children go to government websites to do research about school reports. They don't go there to admire your cartoon characters. And besides, I'm from California. When I think safety, I don't think mountain lion. Here's another gem from the Department of Homeland Security. It's a Mad Lib. Again, children don't go to government websites because they want to play hangman or do mazes. They go there because they want to gather information for school reports. Don't get too far ahead of yourself. Building an embassy or an office in Second Life can be really cool, and it's a lot quieter than a real office or embassy. But you want to build things for the user of the present, not the user of the future. Posting images or videos can seem like it will resolve a controversy, but remember that images can be ambiguous, and there's a lot of ways that you can read them. Also, people might come there looking for conspiracies or clues in every detail. If you ask citizens to share their story, and then you don't seem to do anything special with the stories that they've shared with you, it encourages people to become cynical about user-generated content and the government's relationship to it. It's the internet. They're going to be hackers. You have to think about security, particularly when private information can go over unsecured networks. But there are also griefers, trolls, and spoilers that you have to think about. Half the people who came to this Library of Congress Flickr page said this was a hot babe. The other half said she was an actress and merely faking being a factory worker. On the other hand, don't assume that everyone is messing with you. Artists, activists, and others who protest government policies might have legitimate reasons that they create even parody websites that seem to criticize your content. They have a legitimate reason for wanting to exercise their political speech. And things like Photoshop are a form of political expression. Don't put in legalese that forbids it. And while we're talking about things not to do, please don't put copyright symbols on material that's really in the public domain. This is part of the government record. You're not the movie industry. You're not the recording industry. You don't need to copyright your material. I worry about the proliferation of government domain names in these days. And I think about all these little URLs, and I wonder who's going to take care of them in the future. I just think they're like orphan children, potentially. And think about how Web 2.0 companies have user agreements that really rewrite the social contract in fundamental ways, in ways that can violate privacy, in ways that can undermine free speech, and in ways that can undermine freedom of assembly. Remember, this is the government. It's not a brand. Calvin Klein is a brand. The Gap is a brand. USAID is not a brand. Represents something. And when you're thinking about the digital generation, remember that there are many kinds of people who are adopting new technologies. People of all ages, of all classes, and of many different kinds of backgrounds. That's the exciting thing about this new civic space. Don't rely on cliches. And check out my research and the work of my academic colleagues, and have a great time at Government 2.0. Thanks.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Gov 2.0 conference.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mike Seifried. Our website editor was Brett Ballinger. The series producer is Jacinta Plachinski.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another exciting presentation from the Gov 2.0 conference.